When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
Come on, Bond. Where the hell are you?
2021 was supposed to be the year things returned to normal. Movies that dropped off the 2020 movie calendar, like the new Bond, No Time to Die, would finally make it to the big screen.
And Bond did return. So did high-profile directors such as Wes Anderson, Jane Campion, Steven Spielberg, and Denis Villeneuve. But it didn't exactly feel normal.
In fact, the only normal thing about the year was the quality of films. This week, we start our Best of 2021 countdown with our outlier picks, the movies only one of us deemed top 10 worthy.
It's all ahead on Film Spotting.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hello, Film Spotting friends. My name is Katie Reif, and I'm senior writer at theavclub.com. My number one pick for the best film of 2021 is Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog. I do love a Western, a revisionist Western in particular, and Campion's take on the genre was just beautiful. It's sensual, it's poetic, it's foreboding, it's sinister, it's lovely, all at the same time. So that film's playing on Netflix now. I recommend checking it out, and you can check me out at Rife with Katie on Twitter. Thank you.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Thank you, Katie Rife from the AV Club, for that voicemail. Her number one film of the year, Josh, Jane Campion's The Power of the Dog. Sensual, poetic, sinister, I think sums that film up nicely. But there will be a lot more to say about it as we work our way through our two-part Best of 2021 countdown.
Yeah, might just come up once or twice in the second part of this program.
Indeed. And I'm not sure how I feel about this. We usually try to make these top 10 shows roundtables, but this feels a little bit more like, I don't know, a rectangle, Josh, me across from you sharing this first part of the show.
Well, we have a little experience in doing this, just you and I on the show, so hopefully mm-hmm. that'll help. But yeah, doesn't feel quite the same this year.
No, since 2007, it has been something of a roundtable. We've had at least one special guest, usually Michael Phillips. The last couple of years, it was Michael and Tasha Robinson from Polygon and the Next Picture Show. This year, we were hoping to return to that live roundtable format after a year of doing it virtually. We had Dana Stevens from Slate all set to fly in. And then, you know, the world intruded. The ongoing pandemic put an end to our plans.
Just ridiculous. And, you know, it's like so much right now, the way things are moving. You look back at conversations you were having a week, 10 days ago mm-hmm. and saying, OK, this will work. We can do this. We think there's a smart way to go about this. And then bang, everything kind of gets overturned. But we found a way to forge ahead and do this in a way that's a little safer, a little smarter. And we still get Michael and Dana.
That's right. Tasha already wasn't going to make it because of holiday travel plans, but we do have Michael and Dana all set to join us, and we will hear from them in part two as we share our consensus best films of the year. This is part one, the outlier picks. That doesn't mean we're necessarily the only people who love these movies. It doesn't even necessarily mean that I don't like your picks or you don't like my picks, Josh. I think there's a lot of crossover here in terms of positivity about these films, but it does mean they were unique to our lists. And before we hear our picks, we each have five that did not make anybody else's list, including our guests in part two, Michael and Dana. And before we hear those, I'm curious if there was anything unique for you this year in terms of your process forming this list. Did you notice any commonalities among your picks?
Yeah, the process was pretty much, you know, the same as it is every year, even though the year itself was a bit screwy. It's just starting that document I think I talked about in our bonus show for our Chicago Film Critics Association Awards. I start my top 10 list January 1. You know, I'll be doing it again in a couple of weeks, and just those movies that really moved me the first time I saw them, I put them on there. And so I'm sure I could tease out some themes, have not had time to sit down and see what sort of commonality jumps out at me in terms of the year we're in, the topicality. I know you especially like to do that at the end of the year, so I'm eager to hear if you had a chance to yet. But otherwise, it looks like, you know, my lists normally do kind of all over the place. I've got some documentary representation. I have major filmmakers, a first-time filmmaker. And, you know, the only thing that stands out is I don't think I found a spot for an animated film this year, which I don't know if it speaks to the strength of that category or me just not, you know, seeing the correct films in that category. I mean, I think last year I had Soul pretty high up. So it's something I do try to make space for. I've got a couple here that you might be able to identify, and maybe I'll get into this as we talk about them, as time capsule films. And I don't know if that's because this seems like a particularly momentous time in history that I leaned that way and picked some things that I think might have offer a picture of what life is like right now to future audiences. But that's just a couple. So I don't see one clear through line in my picks at this point. How about you?
Yeah, I will first say that I only saw one animated film this year that I thought was very good to great, and it didn't quite make my top 10. Will come up in our honorable mentions in part two of this countdown, but I didn't really get to see many animated films this year and had nothing to kind of run up against it, at least when I was putting together my Chicago Film Critics Association ballot. That was one category where I felt very deficient, unfortunately, and regret that I didn't get a chance to see more of those films. Maybe I will as we transition into the new year. You're right, I usually do find some kind of unifying theme for my picks, though I will state again, it's never intentional. I don't go into forming the list with an idea in mind and then try to make the picks conform to that. It's usually as I'm jotting down my notes or I'm shifting picks around that I start to look at the titles and start to realize that there are some similarities. And what struck me this year, and I'll note that on a basic level, this is probably exactly what movies are supposed to do and is very obvious. These films just did it particularly well and did it in unique ways. All of my picks have very strongly defined senses of place. And place is twofold. I'm talking about setting and location sometimes, but also psychological space, where you are locked into and experiencing everything through a particular character or characters' perspective. And I was running this by Sam briefly on the phone the other day, and he said, the way you're describing it makes me think of the Charlie Kaufman film from last year, I'm Thinking of Ending Things. And he's right. That's a perfect example, though not all of my choices are necessarily quite that extreme. But these films truly transport you to, or like Jesse Buckley's character in that Charlie Kaufman film, they trap you into a particular time and space. The sights, the sounds, the smells, they're all vivid and detailed and perhaps at times even disorienting. And the places could be very real, could be like The Power of the Dog, Katie's pick, 1920s Montana, or like my number 10 we'll get to in a moment, they could be a heightened fantasy version of a real place.
Yeah, well, my number nine pick, which maybe we'll jump right in and get to our first outlier here, mm-hmm. has a distinct sense of place that I don't think any other filmmaker can offer. I've mentioned Jacques Tati in relation to this filmmaker, but even he, is distinct in terms of maybe a certain cheeriness he has that this filmmaker doesn't bring to his films, even though they're very funny. And I'm talking about Swedish filmmaker Roy Anderson. And my pick, again, it's number nine on my list overall, About Endlessness. I fell under Anderson's spell, you know, this mordant spell of his back when we considered a couple of his movies for our Nordic Cinema Marathon, Adam, a couple years ago now. About Endlessness is something of a bonus film to the tragicomic trilogy that most people know him for. So Songs from the Second Floor, You the Living, and A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence. Like, you know, those titles suggest, About Endlessness is another collection of dryly humorous, immaculately designed fixed camera vignettes. That's the space. You know, as soon as you see a still of a Roy Anderson film, mm-hmm. you know what kind, who made that, those images, right? And who put those yeah. ghostly pale people who look
ghostly
like
pale.
They are on the verge of death in those yeah. in those scenes.
And that grayish brown kind of wallpaper oh. in any indoor scene. I don't know how that production designer finds that material.
Horrible, horrible. And by that, I mean perfect for these films, mm-hmm. production design and furniture. And yes, just rooms. And here in About Endlessness, these rooms, a number of these vignettes are interrupted by a tortured priest, just comes in. It becomes a punchline, even though it's a deeply distressing thing to say. What should I do now that I've lost my faith? It's kind of, you know, imagine Bresson, but as an SNL skit. It's kind of what you're getting with this guy. So yes, this movie is funny, but I will say in thinking about it in the context of those other films I mentioned, I think it might be the bleakest. I don't know what it says as Anderson continues to make movies. There doesn't seem to be a certain contentment to the wisdom he's accruing and showing in his films. They just keep getting, at least this is very bleak for me. So even though it is on Hulu right now, I will say, depending on your level of seasonal affective disorder, proceed with caution. But I am glad it's available, finally available.
Yeah, that's a good warning. Not only is it available, but ironically, when you consider its title, About Endlessness, is very brief. It's actually under 80 minutes.
This is true.
So I was able to fit it in prior to sitting down with you, and I liked it too. It didn't hit me the same way You the Living did or Songs from the Second Floor did during our marathon, but then I was being introduced to a new filmmaker then with a distinct vision and style, and this feels, well, very familiar. It feels like a Roy Anderson film, of course. The humor and the pathos is all there. I guess I just didn't feel it as intensely. And I think maybe one of the reasons I didn't is because there are many more vignettes here than in those other films I mentioned. So the scenes are shorter, and that means there's less room for surprises within those fixed wide frames, even as the composition is still so precise. But that was what always impressed me so much, or actually did surprise me, about the Roy Anderson films during our marathon. You are looking at that frame, studying every inch of it, and then all of a sudden some bit of action appears in the corner.
Sure.
We don't get that as much here. One vignette where we do is the woman who gets off the train, who thinks no one is waiting for her, and she's just sitting on the bench, and then we start to notice a figure, a man, it looks like, scurrying just in the top right of the frame in the distance, and eventually he comes over to the other side of the tracks and does run up to meet her. Spoiler alert, someone was waiting for her. He was just late. So maybe there were fewer moments like that, and that's something that really draws me to Anderson's work. But your review at your website also touched on an element I love in this movie, which is those occasional moments where a character, and maybe it only happens three or four times, looks right at us, looks right into the camera, which is so appropriate for this film, right? This notion of them being seen by us, and in turn us being seen by them. It's the whole Anderson experiment, isn't it? This mutual acknowledgement of the dire situation we're all in together.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, you know, this also features voiceover narration, which I think accentuates that intimacy a little bit, which is a first for him. But maybe you were also cooler on this, Adam, because one thing that's missing is the tuba that we both enjoyed so much in, I forget if it was You the Living that really emphasized that. So that's not here, and that might have held you back just a little bit.
Well, no tubas in About Endlessness, but one or two probably pop up over the course of my first outlier, which is my number 10 film overall. The place is Los Angeles, and the character's perspective is so toxic and venal that sometimes you absolutely want to escape it. Did I mention this movie is a musical and fun as hell? It's Leos Carax's Annette. Sam, our producer, twisted my arm.
Yeah, he wore you down.
He did. It was my final watch before recording, and it paid off for me. That troubling perspective I mentioned belongs to Adam Driver's performance artist slash comedian, who's in love with a talented opera singer played by Marion Cotillard. Everything should be just perfect, right, Josh? Well, nothing is perfect in the world of Annette. And here's our friend Michael Phillips supporting my point about that perspective in his positive Chicago Tribune review. He says it's doggedly intent on putting you inside the mental cauldron of the Driver character as he rails against his own fame, his perceived ugly duckling slash fairy princess relationship with his wife, and the birth of their phenomenal daughter, who is played by wooden puppets of varying sizes. I don't think you need to be familiar with the band Sparks or have seen Edgar Wright's Sparks Brothers documentary, as I did from this year, to appreciate Annette, but I am glad I had that foundation because I was so firmly grounded when things inevitably got really weird, which happens pretty early in Annette following a glorious opening scene.
So good.
That signals for us to settle in and watch the show. The show in this case being this dark fairy tale about romance and revenge. And the opening is one where the director, his daughter, and members of the cast all join Sparks, Ron and Russell Mayall, as they start playing a tune in a recording studio and then spill out onto the streets of LA singing So May We Start.
May we not start to fashion the world, a world built just for you, a tale of songs and fury with no taboo. We'll sing and dance for you, yes, in minor keys. And if you want us to kill too, we may agree. So may we start, may we start, may we.
The joy expressed by those characters in that opening is something I'm not sure you really see again in Annette once the movie starts proper. It's all pretty tortured, and the bleaker and bleaker it got, honestly, Josh, the more I embraced it. And it seems only fitting, since he gave me the nudge, we should go ahead and hear from our producer, Sam, who doesn't think that Annette just belongs in the top 10. He says it's the best film of the year.
Hey, Film Spotting listeners, Sam Van Halgren here, Film Spotting producer. Shout out to anybody whose 2021 was somehow so much worse than their 2020. I'm right there with you. And that extends to my movie watching this year, which is way down. I look at my top 10 and the fact that Eternals is still in the conversation for the top 10 should tell you everything you need to know. And yes, I saw more than 10 movies. As far as my number one movie of the year, I am shocked that I'm not seeing more people come to this movie's defense or champion it at the end of the year. And I'm kind of shocked that it's me that's doing it. It's Leos Carax's Annette. Boy, I love this thing right from the joyous opening, which I just encourage everyone to just... It's there. It's right there on Prime, Amazon Prime, for those of you that have it. Just fire it up. The first 5 minutes are exhilarating, and it really didn't let up for me. It proved, again, that Adam Driver can do no wrong. In fact, he can do things that I don't know if anybody else can do. And I just think it had a lot of very smart things to say about relationships, that every relationship starts in Eden and eventually winds up in hell. And that seems cynical, but I think the musical operatic structure of the movie made a bleak thought like that aesthetically just astounding. It was the most fun I had watching a movie. Yeah, I think it was on my computer screen, if I'm being honest. But I've got a lot of catch up to do, but I encourage anyone who's been resistant to checking out Annette to do it. It is extraordinary. Looking forward to a much better, brighter 2022.
You know, Sam, when he's not giving low star ratings to movies like Almost Famous and all that jazz and ripping my heart out, he's really smart.
I wonder if he's okay. I mean, this is not to cast aspersions on his pick. I liked Annette as well.
Yeah.
Kind of sounds like he needs a hug there, you know?
Maybe. So I hope, maybe. 2021's been rough.
It has been rough. And, you know, yeah. I love this because I love his support of it as number one. Annette is the sort of movie it needs fellow dreamers. It needs passionate supporters because you're right. It is so weird, so on its own wavelength. I'm glad it's gotten that from Sam and now from you.
And if, like me, you skip this one for most of 2021 and you still need to see it, you can do so on Amazon Prime.
All right. My next outlier is Memoria. This is the latest from cinema spiritualist Pichapong Wirasatakul. But before I say more about it, let's hear from a critic and friend of the show, Isaac Feldberg, about another movie.
Hi, Adam and Josh. Isaac Feldberg here. Thanks for having me. My favorite film released this year in the United States was This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection, which is currently available to rent or on the Criterion Channel for those who subscribe to that. It's a magical realist parable from a Lesotan filmmaker named Limoang Jeremiah Masese. It centers on an 80-year-old widow played by the late South African actress Mary Twala, who's resisting the forced resettlement of her village in Lesotho. She's grieving unimaginable losses and angered by the prospect of exhuming her dead from the local cemetery, which outsiders are looking to flood before building a dam. The displacement that she feels is not only of those living on the land, but those who've been lowered into it. And through the elliptical style of the film, which foregrounds the majesty of all of the landscapes around her, the cry of defiance of this widow is picked up by the other villagers and then by the earth itself. There's just this lived pain and resilience that Twala brings to this film, which was her last film role, that sets off shockwaves so deep and kind of monumental that they break the world of the film open. The result is one of the most hypnotic and devastating times I've had at the movies in recent years. I'm a freelance pop culture critic and journalist, most regular to RogerEbert.com, Paste, The Playlist, and Inverse. You can follow me at Twitter or Letterboxd at Isaac Feldberg. And thanks again for having me contribute to this. It's been a great year for movies.
Mari, how katea tsebe, mubungwa nazareta, waka ikukala di lo, le di tsebo tsa bafu.
I agree with everything Isaac says there. Burial is actually my number 12 film of the year. And when he talks about the sense of displacement in the movie, I'd add that there is a spiritual sense of displacement too. This widow who's mourning the recent death of her son, she's in such distress that she finds herself longing for death. And, you know, in the process of that, kind of finds herself in this strange liminal space. She's pining for loved ones lost. She's aching for her own death. But then as Isaac described, she's also fiercely tied to a specific earthly place. Now, this is sort of the space that Wirasatakul is exploring as well. He definitely does it in Memoria. It's my number 7 film of the year. And here Tilda Swinton plays a Scottish woman in Colombia who's haunted by this randomly occurring sonic boom that only she can hear.
It's like a rumble from the core of the earth. Bang! And then it shrinks.
As the movie goes on and it employs these long, fixed takes, has a really startling sound design, you feel like it's peeking behind a veil, between this world and another, in a way that really is similar to This Is Not a Burial, It's a Resurrection. It's also similar, you know, to the work of someone as massive as Andrei Tarkovsky for me. So these two movies, very different in so many ways, but are kind of linked in my head in this way. Unfortunately, Memoria, there's been talk about this release strategy that's planned going into 2022, where it's only going to play a theater at a time for possibly a week or a limited amount of, severely limited amount of time. So difficult one to catch up with. I was able to see it on the big screen at the Chicago International Film Festival. Thankfully for critics who are lucky enough to get the Neon Awards package of DVD screeners, they did include it in that. So I think you were able to see it that way, right, Adam?
Mm-hmm. I was, and I do regret with this movie. I regret it with all movies, but especially this film, because of the aesthetic approach, because of the sound design, I wish I'd had that theatrical experience. And I'd love to hear maybe a little bit more even about how it impacted you, specifically that bang or that sonic boom. The screener copy you mentioned that we got from Neon, you've got Tilda and the director, who goes by Joe, doing a little introduction and basically apologizing for the fact that what you're about to see was not intended for whatever screen and sound system you're watching it on. But still, that bang that awakens Swinton's character, Jessica, and harasses her throughout the film was jarring enough. And I think about Swinton in the scene with the recording engineer when he finds the sound
yes.
most closely matches. Her reaction isn't just one of recognition, it's one of like existential angst.
Yeah.
It provokes something primal. There's something mythical about this sound, and the way she responds to it makes you feel, not just in this scene, but in subsequent scenes, makes you feel the assault of that sound, to the point that when you're not just listening closely to the sound design overall and kind of seeking any clues, you're like her, scared it's going to attack you again any second. And I think that lack of any rhyme or reason is really what is terrifying in the way this movie, which is decidedly not a horror movie, is terrifying.
Yeah, we talk about a couple factors when we talk about the allure of seeing a film in a theater, you know, and some of them are technical. The size of the screen, the soundscape, which is crucial here, as you described, especially in that sequence with the sound designer, the sound engineer, but also the communal experience. And when you recognize this was a fairly full showing at the Chicago International Film Festival, when you first hear that noise and everyone in the theater is disturbed at the same moment, mm-hmm. and kind of like, if they don't physically, a lot of people do kind of physically jump every time it occurs, but it just creates this sense of unease that you can feel in the air. And so that's, you know, kind of what a distinct element of seeing it with a crowd beyond those technical elements that you were discussing.
Going to my second outlier film, it is my number 9 overall, Paul Schrader and The Card Counter. After placing very high on my list a few years ago for First Reformed, he's back with a film that is a nice companion to that movie, though this one's set in the world of casinos and a gambler who goes by the name William Tell, played by the great Oscar Isaac. The place, as I said, is this faux glamour of these casinos, along with the cafes and the motel rooms that are the milieu of a man who makes his living going town to town playing cards, trying to simply exist, or exist simply, not because subsistence is all he's capable of, but because of what he's capable of if he doesn't limit himself to subsistence. And that's where the psychological aspect comes in here as well, through the repetition of his routine, the journaling he's doing, which we hear in voiceover, the flashbacks, the use of the camera in the flashbacks, in particular, these scenes of torture at Abu Ghraib that are witnessed through a really disorienting fisheye lens. We're never distanced from Will's experience of the world. I was rewatching a scene yesterday online, and it's one with Isaac and his co-stars Ty Sheridan and Tiffany Haddish. They're having dinner, one shot, at one of the casino restaurants sort of in between games, and it starts on a wide shot showing all three of them with Isaac in the center of the frame, and as they talk, the camera just slowly tracks forward until it's just on him in a medium close-up. It's not uncomfortably close at all, but again, it's Schrader just focusing on him and what he's thinking. We're watching him listen, we're watching him react, and then finally respond.
How much cards do you play?
40 hands an hour, 8 to 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week.
Do you do anything else?
Like what?
Like anything. Go to a park, a concert, a museum.
A museum? Yeah, I'll buy you a book on it. It's called Museums for Dummies. No, but seriously, you should do something else. Just for variety.
I like playing cards.
You think about this environment of the world of poker and gambling as well. The game isn't happening on the table. It's in the card player's head. It's what he has, what he thinks the other players have, determining odds, anticipating the moves they're going to make. And I love this line. There are many lines I love from this screenplay. I think it's one of the best of the year. But at one point, Isaac says, "The house doesn't mind players who count cards. They don't even mind players who count cards and win. What they don't like are players who count cards and win big. It's about how much you win and how you win it. And I stick to modest goals." In Paul Schrader's world, I think it's about how much you lose too and how you lose it. And he poses the question in this film about the possibility for redemption with a character who seems to have come to terms with the fact that redemption, I'm sorry to say it, isn't in the cards. And if that sounds a little too cute, well, I do think Schrader has found in poker the perfect metaphor for the struggle that is life. Another line from this movie, poker is all about the waiting. Hours pass, days pass, hand after hand, each hand like the hand before, then something happens. Pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely a worthy follow-up to his first Reformed, just in terms of ideas and close in terms of execution, I would say. As you're describing it, you know, it's almost more religiously explicit than First Reformed, even though the main character there is a pastor, right? So it's interesting. And just to touch quickly back on the idea of sound design, I think about the ominous breathing that we hear throughout this movie. I still don't know, you know, who it's supposed to be associated with. If it is Isaac's main character, or if it's just some other presence that's kind of bearing down on us and amping up the angst. But that's an element that stood out to me from the card counter for sure. You can see the card counter right now on most platforms. It's available for rent. And actually, Adam, you added number 9. You know who liked it even better than you?
Who?
Paul Schrader. I saw.
Well,
did you see?
I saw that.
He put it at best film
of
the year.
God bless him. God bless him. I think every filmmaker should just be honest and make their film number one.
So
that's
good.
That's the brashness we love in a Paul Schrader.
Uh-huh. All right. So my next outlier, my number 5 film of 2021 is Zola. And this is, I mentioned, you know, how there's a couple time capsule picks maybe on my list. This is one of those. I think it gives a real sense of what, you know, living on a social media dominated planet circa 2021. I know the events are, I think, around 2015 based here, but still, this is just such a social media driven picture in terms of narrative and style that I think it would offer, you know, 30, 40 years from now, an interesting snapshot of what life was like for certain people. It is based on a series of tweets. These purportedly shared the details of this wild trip to Tampa that a waitress and stripper made with another dancer that she didn't really know, just met, but decided to go on this trip with. And director Janitska Bravo delivers something, I would say it's as stimulating and also as anxiety producing as scrolling through Twitter for 90 minutes, depending on your feed. Now, that sounds horrible, maybe, but this is really entertaining too. And that's thanks not only to the filmmaking, the editing, the chirps in the sound design here, more sound work, that's crucial. But as I talked about on our Chicago Film Critics Association ballot show, Adam, Taylor Page's comedic side eye of a performance as the main character here.
This is messy. You are messy. Your brain is broke.
Is this what you came here for, Zola?
Do it look like I came for this?
The proudest money you made. I'm so proud of you.
How would you? No more.
I didn't do nothing wrong.
Yes, ma'am.
I've already praised her. I've heard a rumor, Adam. This is another one you managed to squeeze in. I cannot wait to hear what you thought of Zola, especially because I think you liked it.
Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. And I didn't see Lemon as you did. So after seeing Zola, I'm definitely curious about whatever Bravo does next. And actually looking at your website and your review of the film, the shot that is your image is one of the great shots in this movie.
The standoff.
That speaks to the style, right? Where there's so much closeness. Everything is too intimate in this movie, even when the two characters might be just talking to each other, sharing DMs, and we're hearing what they're saying, almost like it's voice transcribing. And that shot, this is where the split actually happens, and Bravo emphasizes that by making it seem almost like, with this barrier between them in this hotel room, it's as if the room is split in two. It almost feels like it's two separate shots bumped up next to each other. So there's a lot of great touches like that. And I do get the affection for all of the performances. I know you brought this up in terms of Keo being the one who's getting all the attention, which kind of makes sense because it's the big performance compared to Paige.
She's a lot of fun, too.
But she's a lot of fun. And I think she's very good. I think she's appropriately big for her character.
Yes.
And Colman Domingo, he maybe wouldn't have made my top five Chicago Film Critics ballot in the supporting actor category had I seen it prior to voting, but he's really good. And the moment I love, or the moments I should say, are when he only falls into his Nigerian accent when he's angry and animated and about to get violent, because like everyone else in this movie, he's always projecting an image of himself, right?
Yes.
He wants to be the smart, kind of sophisticated, fun businessman. And he will be that right up until he gets pushed over a certain line. Taylor Paige, the fascinating thing for me is the way she plays the character is entirely consistent with how you would expect the person telling the story to portray herself. She's, from very early on, self-aware and skeptical and annoyed with the people she's now trapped in a car with. She's really business savvy. And somehow, I wonder how you feel about this, Josh, somehow she never really seems to be scared. I mean, truly scared, no matter how terrifying some of these situations get. And they really do. She never fully betrays that fear. And I almost wish the movie had interrogated that idea a little bit more. And what made me think they might is that they have some fun, Bravo does, with the storytelling perspective. About three quarters of the way through, the movie shifts temporarily from Zola to Stephanie.
Yes, I love that.
It restarts with a new title, and now it's Keo's character who's addressing the camera, and she's portraying herself as this Christ-loving woman who is being misrepresented by a jealous former friend. But that's really just a quick detour for a laugh, and as false as it almost surely is, it still struck me that I'm not sure how much more reliable it is than what Zola is giving us. But Bravo is taking Zola's narrative at face value, which is thrilling and scary. Yes, and anxiety inducing, as you said, at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's harrowing what we see. And I don't know, you're totally right. This is Zola's perspective, and we should interrogate that and question that. I think that's kind of at the root of what the movie is really about. Yet we definitely are rooting for her to get out of this alive. I don't know if I necessarily needed more vulnerability from her, just because I felt that that sense of danger was so palpable already. I don't know if I could have taken it if she, you know, it was, I wonder if that's another projection of hers to seem that strong, to seem that in control, just because it might be the only way she gets out of the particular situation she's in. And so a little more vulnerability, I don't know if it might have been too much for me to even take.
Zola available now for rental on most platforms, also free if you have a Showtime subscription. My next outlier is my number 7 film of the year, and just as skilled in its craft as Zola, though the exact opposite in terms of its formal approach. It's The Killing of Two Lovers, which is a film written and directed by a new filmmaker to us, Robert Michoyan. He made one previous feature, When She Runs, made a lot of shorts and documentary shorts over the past decade or so, but this is the first time he's been on our radar. And the plot description, pretty simply, is a man, David, played by Clayne Crawford, who is trying to keep his family together. He has 4 children. He is separated at the moment from his wife, and they've agreed to see other people. And we see right from the beginning, and we'll get into that a bit more here in a second, that he is not accepting this new arrangement very well. The place here, the Utah flatlands, the mountains and the sparse landscapes loom large, but are juxtaposed with a very small town in a very small space that is shared by this husband and father who is estranged from his wife and kids, but whatever distance has come between them as a couple, there's really no physical distance possible as he sees his house from his father's house where he's staying every time he walks out the door. The 4-3 aspect ratio here heightens that sense of confinement. It keeps us focused on the characters versus it being that kind of widescreen, grandiose image of those imposing landscapes. And then the psychological aspect here and the way we're seeing everything through this character's eyes. The movie opens with David, and since this is the opening of the movie, I don't feel I'm spoiling anything, pointing a gun at a man and a woman in a bed. We soon learn that it's his bed, his wife, in bed with another man. And what's so evocative about it, besides how chilling it is that for a second, I assumed Machoikin was starting the movie at the end, because something as dramatic as considering shooting two people seems like something you would build to. Everything we'll see over the course of the movie unfold will show us how David got to that choice. And that is true, except it's not the end. It really is the beginning. And while we're obviously entering the story at a point where they've already had to make some really difficult decisions as a couple that he is struggling with, how hurt and lost must someone feel to be that close to doing something so final and devastating? That's how we meet David. And every conversation, every argument, every slight, perceived or intentional, we then see is informed by that knowledge of where he is starting psychologically. And a layer of tension is added to every scene after it when you know the level of pain he's feeling and the destructive mindset that he's in.
Look, there's nothing I can say to you that's not going to make me out to be a loser dad. Okay? You're right. Okay? But I'm not going to make your mom out to be the villain in this thing. She's not a bad person. Look, Jess, we got married right out of high school. We had you, then the boys. We never knew that we were gonna question things when we got older.
That's bull.
It is not bull. You know, I wish somebody would have told me that it's never gonna stop. It's never gonna get easy, okay? You're not gonna just be an adult and all of a sudden you don't question anything that happens in life. We're trying, Jess, but there's no daggum roadmap. Okay?
Why can't you guys just be together? Like Grandma and Grandpa. They've been together for years.
We're trying, Jess.
There are many more camera choices and visual decisions that I would love to break down, but as this is a film I know we're going to consider for this year's Golden Brick, I'm hoping we're going to have more opportunities to talk about it as we get into the new year. And I can't wait for more people to see The Killing of Two Lovers, available on most VOD platforms, but also free with a Hulu premium subscription.
I'm one of those people. I still need to see it for consideration for the Golden Brick. We're going to share the full list of our finalists when we come back. That way, listeners can start catching up too and be ready to vote in our 2021 Brick poll. Before we get to the poll and the rest of our outlier picks, we have a couple more guest voicemails to share, including one from our own production assistant, Kat Sullivan.
Hey, Adam and Josh. Kat Sullivan here, calling in with my favorite film of 2021. Which, because I'm a huge softie, is Mike Mills' very gentle, gorgeous Come On, Come On. I was a big fan of 20th Century Women and of Beginners, so I was ready to like this, but wow, it really blew me away. I was really taken with the black and white cinematography here and how that supported its theme of memory and the world that these characters inhabit. And it's also probably my favorite Joaquin Phoenix performance other than The Master now. And really reminded me what a tender and introspective actor he can be. It does share a lot with 20th Century Women in terms of the gulf that can exist between parent and child, and how the people who are closest to us are sometimes the people that we know the least. Watching this, I was reminded of a quote from 20th Century Women as well, which was, "You get to see him out in the world as a person. I never will." I found myself wishing that when I was Jesse's age, we had the same technology that radio journalist Johnny has in Come On, Come On, so that I could remember those days just like he will. Thanks so much, guys. Come On, Come On, my favorite film of 2021.
Hi, guys. This is Scott Tobias. I am the co-host of Film Spotting's sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. I also write for The Reveal, our new newsletter on Substack, so please subscribe to that. Anyway, for me, this year has been the year of Ryuzuki Hamaguchi. In fact, I wrote an essay on the reveal with that very title. Drive My Car and Wheel of Fortune and Fantasy are both top five movies to me. But my number one is Drive My Car because it's just so multi-layered and surprising. This is a film about grief following a play director who's staging Uncle Vanya after his wife's death. And his memories of her are complicated by infidelity. But the film has so much to say about human nature and how we process loss and how we could never really know a person. And beyond that, it's a really great movie about the artistic process and performance. I feel like this is a movie and a filmmaker that will be studied a long time. So it's been a great year for movies again. It's been good to see just like a full crop of films. And so I had a great year and I hope you did too. Thank you so much.
One day there might be money coming in on the side. You know there may not be a need to fuss. I think I see a light on the horizon, but it may just be the city bus. One day my jackets might not be lifted. One day my numbers might not be so red. One day I may lay beside somebody I love in something bigger than a twin size bed. In something bigger than a twin size bed.
What's the post-grad plan then?
Well, are they taking care of you, making enough money now from the babysitter?
No, Dad, not nearly enough considering all the hard work that I'm doing.
Oh, it's a good thing that you don't need the money.
I'm saving up for something.
Oh, yeah, well, what are you saving up for? Your own apartment?
Yes, she's doing just that. Daddy's not going to be paying for that apartment forever.
But she's very hardworking.
Listen, maybe you and Max could discuss this in more detail together.
Yes,
I mean, maybe he could help you find the ideal position.
Yeah, I'm sure he can, but I already have a plan and a path, so I don't
Look,
need that.
Sweetheart, feminism isn't exactly what I call a career.
It's not,
you know?
My career, it's a lens. Through which to see my career.
Oh, look, I'm sorry.
That was a clip coming out of the break from Emma Seligman's Shiva Baby. A film didn't make either of our lists, but I think we both liked it quite a bit, Adam, and actually is a Golden Brick contender.
Yeah, we definitely liked it enough to put it among our five finalists for the Golden Brick. It's an award we've been giving out since 2009 to our favorite overlooked or underseen film of the year from a new or emerging director. This comes with some pedigree, Josh. Our previous winners include Sean Baker for Tangerine, Yorgos Lanthimos for Dogtooth, and Koganada for Columbus. The way it works is we nominate films throughout the year. We give them at least a few minutes on the show, if not a full review at the end of the year. Then we narrow that list of nominees down to usually about five finalists, and we vote. You and I get a vote. Our producer Sam gets a vote. The Film Spotting VIPs, the members of our extended family, that would be the hosts of the Next Picture Show, plus Michael Phillips, plus the former hosts of Film Spotting SVU, Matt Singer and Allison Wilmore, they all get to chime in. And, of course, we can't forget the listeners. They get to vote as well via filmspotting.net. And that's when your favorite part, the math, gets involved, Josh.
Oh, man, it's more convoluted than Netflix's algorithm for what they serve up next to you.
It might just be. So we're simply asking you, what film should win the 2021 Golden Brick Award? And we will choose from all of these votes. The winner of this poll will get the most points for consideration in that complicated formula. The choices, Josh, are
Identifying Features from Fernanda Valadez. We'll hear a little bit more about that one in just a bit. The Killing of Two Lovers from Robert Machoian. Adam, as he mentioned, has that as number 7 for him this year. 9 Days from Edson Oda, St. Maud from Rose Glass, and then the film we just heard, Shiva Baby from Emma Seligman. You can vote in the poll right now. It's up. It's ready for you at filmspotting.net, though, of course, you know, you've got some time as well if you need to do some homework and catch one or two or more of those finalists. You can find out more information about them and where to watch them at filmspotting.net/bricks. We're going to announce the winner of the 2021 Golden Brick Award next month during our 2021 wrap party.
Now, I'm not trying to sway it in any way. Obviously, we know which film I'm leaning towards because it's the only one that's on my top 10 list. You have only one of these on your top 10 list. But I think the movie that maybe has the best shot if enough people catch up with all these titles, I think it might be 9 Days. Do you have a favorite among the listeners?
A prediction? Yeah, I think, you know, I'd fight more fiercely for you with you over our personal favorites, but I think those two, the ones we both like the best, might fare the least well. Just a little lower under the radar, maybe. So 9 Days, I've seen a lot of love for, understandably so. But I think it could have competition from Shiva Baby. People seem to feel as passionately about that one. So yeah, I'm eager to see how this plays out.
Identifying Features is the first film by director Fernanda Valadez. It's a Mexican film that, like many others in the last few years, centers on the drug-related violence that has afflicted Mexico for over a decade now. But this one is particularly unique in that it follows a mother searching for her child, and it's a devastating film. It's a hard watch, I'll say, but I feel like it's an important film, and the way that it handles the sort of darkness and the evil that prevails, in this violent situation, just truly left me speechless. I won't reveal more, but this is a mother who's trying to find her son, whether he's dead or alive. And just the fact that the premise begins with her, you know, anticipating that it's very likely that what she will find are his remains and not, you know, him alive, just sets a tone for how powerful and how difficult, this story can be. And, you know, but the director handles it with such a beautiful eye and, you know, delves into abstract sort of imagery to convey the sort of point and message of this film. So it opened back in January. And so it's been a little bit forgotten now, I feel, but hopefully more people will watch it, you know, as it receives, you know, praise at the end of the year, hopefully. Thank you.
Thanks to critic and trivia spotting participant Carlos Aguiar for sharing his pick, Identifying Features. Carlos also has bylines at the LA Times, New York Times, and RogerEbert.com. Identifying Features is, you know, it's an outlier for our roundtable, but actually really high on my list, Adam. I've got it at number 2. I was wowed by this one, and I think Carlos points to one of the reasons it stood out to me. He used words like darkness and evil, and that's really it. You know, the plot description maybe makes it sound like a film that's about socio-political realities, about news headlines, and it is that for sure, but in the filmmaking, which kind of sneaks up on you, we get this sense of dark, even demonic forces at play. So trust me, this is sort of what you expect, but also not at all what you expect when you sit down to watch Identifying Features. And yeah, as the first film of Fernanda Valadez, it's one of our Golden Brick finalists. Definitely encourage folks to give it a look before voting in the poll. It's the one I'm pulling for, but maybe partly because of that darkness, I don't see that it will take the vote, which is fine as long as more people get to see it, which they can. Right now, Identifying Features is available via most VOD platforms.
So I'm putting it off until I do my final Golden Brick prep as we get ready to announce that winner in January. But it is some of those terms that you've used, that Carlos has used. I know I'm being a wimpy critic here, but I'm all good with that darkness and the harrowing nature of the material and the demonic aspect of it when it's something like a net that I know is all so artificial and fun. As I said before, this feels very real.
Yeah.
And it feels as if I need to be in a certain headspace myself in order to fully take it in. And that might be best for me once I get through this onslaught of cramming in movies at the end of the year.
Yeah, you can't really, after seeing it, you can't really shelve it away in the realm of fantasy or you know, psychological exploration inside one person's head. Like this is darkness that's real, that's out there, that is coming after a lot of people in precarious situations. So it's one to make some psychological space for.
I've got some support as we get to my next outlier. Also jumping up to a high slot on my list, my number 4 film of the year, Sarah Welch Larson is going to do the honors.
Hi, Adam and Josh. This is Sarah Welch Larson calling in with my favorite movie of 2021. I found myself completely disarmed by Michael Cernofsky's Pig. It's a gentle movie with a really brusque performance by Nicolas Cage at its core, but it also doesn't really care what you think about it either way. Its camera work is lush when it's portraying food and spiky and handheld just about everywhere else, with a bronzed quality to the color grading that feels time-worn rather than sentimental. I won't spoil the plot, except to say that this movie doesn't really care about that either. It just exists to de-escalate instead of driving the stakes higher. Nicolas Cage's character says that you don't really get a lot of things to really care about in life, and you don't really get a lot of movies this disarming either. It certainly brought my defenses down when I watched it. Thanks.
Sarah, who has also joined us as a trivia spotting captain this year, and who this year published Becoming Alien, a feminist theological meditation on evil. A lot of evil talk in this show, Josh, in all six Alien movies. If that sounds like your bag, that's available now. Pig is definitely my bag, though I had no idea what that was going to be going into the movie and didn't really know what it was moment to moment in this film. I love the constant surprises of this movie, the directing debut of Michael Sarnowski, starring Nicolas Cage as a truffle hunter who lives in the Oregon wilderness, and his beloved pig is kidnapped, which sends him on a journey to try to reclaim his pig while also having to revisit some traumas from his past in Portland. And Sarah said it, that's the line, right? We don't get a lot to care about. It's the answer, or maybe the challenge, to your pick about endlessness. Maybe be content with being alive.
Yeah, right.
You know, we don't get a lot of things to really care about. About Endlessness is a filmmaker showing you all of the things that make it almost impossible to be content with being alive. And Pig, I think, is a filmmaker showing you all of the things you can really care about and forcing you to be mindful of those things. The place, as I mentioned, starts in the Oregon wilderness, and then it plays out mostly in a twisted version of Portland that is like something out of John Wick, with this thriving underground and a secret fighting rink that, I could be wrong if I recall correctly though, seems to be made up primarily of members who are from the food industry,
you know,
and they're betting on fighting.
I've been thinking about this, and I will probably be corrected if I get it wrong. I think what's going on is that wait staff are getting a chance to beat the crap out of chefs.
Okay. I'll go with that.
I think, maybe.
Well, that certainly seems right to me, Josh. Pig, a movie I am eager to revisit. The psychological space, Nicolas Cage's character, Robin, he's certainly not keen on letting anyone into it, but he is our guide through this world who is single-mindedly focused on one thing, getting that pig back. And there is a lot more to his past, as I alluded to, and there's much more to him that we only discover as the mystery does unfold. I think Sarah said it very well. The cinematography that is time-worn rather than sentimental. I called its look and the production design during our review grungily meticulous. She noted how deliberate it is in its approach, the still shots versus the use of handheld. And I think deliberate's the key word. Every shot reflects a choice. Just as this movie says, we all, every day, get to choose to care. Because we don't have to care. And in those choices, there is a seriousness, there's a solemnity to it, despite the absurdity, which, again, is kind of just like life, isn't it? And what better actor to embody all of this than the man who has given us some of the screen's most absurd moments, but can also carry the weight of that seriousness and solemnity? He is here, I was going to say, maybe as subdued as he's ever been. Is there really a Cage performance that matches this one in terms of its subtlety and its volume, if you will? But he inhabits a character who only acts with directness and with purpose.
They're not real. You get that, right? None of it is real. The critics aren't real. The customers aren't real. Because this isn't real. You aren't real.
Okay.
Derek, why do you care about these people? They don't care about you. None of them. They don't even know you. Because you haven't shown them. Every day you'll wake up and there'll be less of you. You live your life for them and they don't even see you. You don't even see yourself. We don't get a lot of things to really care about.
As I mentioned, Michael Sarnowski's directing debut, he also wrote the screenplay as well, would be a surefire Golden Brick contender. Some have called us out on that, Josh, if it wasn't maybe just a little bit too big for the Golden Brick. Small film overall, but one that got a fair amount of acclaim with Cage as the lead and also did play on a fair number of screens. I'll close with this from Joel Copling, a listener in our poll. His answer to the best film of the year, he says, as of this writing, I still have 4 weeks to go, but I doubt anything can top Michael Sarnowski's Pig, which is not only the best film of the year, but the most assured feature directorial debut in the last several years. Sarnowski takes a premise that can only be called John Wick with a pig, and the casting of Nicolas Cage, which takes on a different meaning now than during his peak as an actor, and uses them to explore the loneliness, legacy, and love within its troubled and devastated protagonist. It might be a kidnapped animal movie, but it has its roots as firmly in vengeful Keanu Reeves as in Kelly Reichardt. I might tip it a little bit more towards the Kelly Reichardt end of that scale, but yes, as we alluded to, that vengeance part certainly is there. It's a wild ride. It's one that's hard to actually describe to people, and the less I say about it, the better, honestly, because I hope people can go in as fresh as I did and go on that journey with Pig, which is available on most VOD platforms, and you can see it for free on Hulu.
Yeah, the assuredness really does stand out, and I think you described it as control that Sarnowski has. But what I love about Pig is that here's a filmmaker who prioritizes that, is capable of that, and then casts Cage because, you know, there's your wild card, as I think we discussed when we reviewed the film. Now, as to if there's a more subdued Cage performance, we'll probably have to wait till we get Keith Phipps on the show next year to talk about his new book, Age of Cage, and we've gone through Cage's filmography a little bit more, but I would say quickly that there's a lot of caginess in this movie still. I mean, think about another great line, F Seattle. I mean, that's the Nick Cage that we're looking for, and maybe the trailer's promise. So there's a little bit of that in here, but yeah, there's also the thoughtfulness, the loneliness, the grief, the anger that is under the surface in this performance. So I just love that Sarnowski was willing to open his controlled movie up to a presence like Cage, give Cage the room, you know, not to control him necessarily. And it's, in some ways, it's almost a miracle that it all worked as well as it does. All right. So we're up to my outlier. That is also my number three film of the year, The French Dispatch. Everyone is rolling their eyes now.
Shocker.
Shocking. I've said a ton about this on the show already, but I don't think I've touched on an element that made this Wes Anderson film particularly catnip for me. And it's also something that Joel Mayward mentioned in his recent Letterboxd review. Joel is an assistant professor at George Fox University. Here's what he wrote. A writer's film about cinema and a filmmaker's film about writing. I loved every bit of it. And that captures it for me. It's funny, actually, that Joel pointed this out. I have the privilege of editing Joel's stuff on occasion at the day job over at Think Christian. Joel is a regular contributor. And, you know, I still consider myself a writer at heart. But really, if I look at it, editing is the majority of my work these days. It's what I spend probably the majority of my time doing. And so I'd paraphrase Joel to say that The French Dispatch, which is, you know, really an obituary to Bill Murray's editor of the fictional magazine to the title, it's an editor's film about cinema and a filmmaker's film about editing. You can see that in the narrative, of course, but you also see it in the filmmaking, how the choices are guided by Murray's character from kind of beyond the grave. You know, he's leading these writers, honoring their voices, challenging them to do their best work within the context of the magazine that he presides over. And I love the line that the film's narrator says, Angelica Houston, early on, I think it is, these were his people.
Good writers. He coddled them, he coaxed them, he ferociously protected them.
What do you think?
For myself? I would start with Mr. Sazerac.
These were his people.
That's That's how it feels on the good days as an editor. And I just love that the French Dispatch, on top of all the other stuff that I've talked about loving in this movie, I love how it celebrates that. So this is one probably a lot of listeners have already seen, but if not, it is available now, I think, to purchase on VOD platforms. So check it out. Buckle in. It's a lot of Wes. But it's worth it.
Yeah, it's an honorable mention for me. So in my top 15 at the moment, and we did spend a fair amount of time, or at least I know it was brought up during our review proper of The French Dispatch, that notion that there is something Anderson seems to be tapping into and suggesting about the artistic process and perhaps his own artistic process and seeing himself as arguably the Bill Murray character, but also all the writers simultaneously. He's the kind of rogue artist who's getting to do exactly what he wants, and he's going to be supportive of each artist under him to let them have free rein, as opposed to necessarily forcing them to be restricted to just his kind of artistic purview. And that maybe even is counter to what you think of with Wes Anderson, but I don't feel as if with that ensemble, he's ever trying to, for lack of a better word, compress any of these actors or limit them in what they're doing. He's trying to give them a place where they can actually do exactly what they were made for.
Yes, that's it. Right, exactly. It's a little bit going back to Pig, you know, is like creating this environment for Cage to be at his best in the varied ways he can be at his best. And I think that's what Anderson is doing here for this ensemble cast.
That point of view also touches on the moment that we've referenced multiple times. You brought it up during our Best Performances show last week. We both had Jeffrey Wright quite high, and the reference was to a line near the end of the film shared between him and Bill Murray. I danced around it so much during our review. I said, I think it's one of the detail that's expressed there is one of the saddest moments and most profound moments in any Wes Anderson film. And again, I didn't want to spoil it for anybody who was hearing our review before they'd seen the movie. And my daughter Sophie, who watched the movie with me, she listened to it and came home that day and was like, what line are you talking about? Explain it. You know, she thought I was too vague. And of course, there in the kitchen, I could give her my spiel. And maybe we'll get a chance to get into that spiel a little bit, because I think that moment has about three or four layers to it, Josh. And I'm still at a point where, as of this recording, I don't want to give it away, but maybe when we get into our favorite moments and scenes of the year at our rap party, we can spoil The French Dispatch a little bit.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, I think, you know, most moving moments, there's a couple you could pick from The French Dispatch.
My final outlier is a movie I have very high as well. Actually, my number two film of the year, and was a very, very strong contender for number one. Here's listener Nick Muldoon. He says, when I first saw Joachim Trier's The Worst Person in the World, it was my 28th film of the Toronto International Film Festival. I definitely pushed myself too far this fest and hit a wall. I stayed at the worst Airbnb imaginable, where I spent most days running on 2 to 3 hours of sleep. The final day, I had even spent most of the morning being completely miserable and just trying to keep myself awake. And then this movie started, and I had goosebumps from its first frame to its last. I felt invigorated for every minute of its 2-hour runtime and just sat there with a dumb smile on my face even during the film's most painful moments, because I knew I was watching something that would mean a lot to me for years to come. I could talk about how the film explores Trier's favorite themes of identity, nostalgia, romance, and ambition, and the warmth and empathy it does so with. Or I could talk about Renata Reintzeva's performance, the best of the year. What I mainly want to just talk about is how happy I was that a movie could make me feel this way. Oslo, August 31st, was one of my favorite films of the 2010s, and somehow Trier has crafted something at a completely different register, but every bit its equal. Trier's film single-handedly woke me from whatever funk or fatigue I was feeling and reminded me just why I love cinema. My favorite film not only of this year, but of this very young decade. First off, Nick, thanks for that. And 28 films at Toronto? I wonder how many days that span, Josh, because I've never stayed for the entire Toronto Film Festival, but my record for a fest was 24.
I mean, I hope Nick's okay. I hope he's physically recovered at this point.
Has he recovered since September? I hope so as well. I did not see The Worst Person in the World at a festival, but I might have watched it in a similarly haggard state here as we're cramming at the end of the year. And yeah, Nick and I saw the exact same movie. If you read just a quick plot description of this movie, there's no reason to ever bother to see it. Josh, I'll give you two versions here, a slightly longer and a shorter I found online. The chronicle of 4 years in the life of Julie, a young woman who navigates the troubled waters of her love life and struggles to find her career path, leading her to take a realistic look at who she really is. Or shorter, a young woman battles indecisiveness as she traverses the troubled waters of her love life and struggles to find her career path. Well, neither are inaccurate, and I do feel for whoever had to be the blurbist there, because it would be very hard to sum this movie up in just a sentence or two, and I don't think any quick paragraph could give you a sense of how smart and insightful and ultimately moving, and as Nick said, invigorating, how exhilarating this movie is. I also was a big fan of Oslo, August 31st. I had it as my number 7 film of 2012. And looking back at my notes, I remarked on how staid and subtle the direction is. Well, I don't know if you've looked up staid in the dictionary recently, but it means sedate, respectable, and unadventurous. And obviously here in Worst Person in the World, this is Trier working in a completely different mode.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's exactly Zola, but it it moves similarly.
There's some flourishes.
There are some flourishes in the editing, in some of the visual choices. It has, I think, the same drive and passion that the main character Julie does. And yes, Nick is right. This is the performance of the year in a role that was written for her, even though it is her first lead screen role. What the movie is ultimately about is how Julie has all of that drive and passion with nowhere to direct it. And slight spoiler, not really, she's not the worst person in the world. It's a reference to someone else in the movie, actually, who isn't the worst person in the world either. There is a hyperbolic, self-deprecating nature to that phrase as it's employed here, but the person using it explains it as a feeling of being lesser than. And that's what Julie is so in search of, I think. A feeling, meaning, something that is intangible and unattainable. And I think why the movie is maybe so intoxicating for people like Nick and like me is that it is so effective at portraying a variety of feelings, these moments in life that are intoxicating if you're lucky enough or if you're bold enough to actually experience them. And I'm thinking about one scene in the movie, one extended sequence in the movie, for example, when she meets a new man, Ivan, at a wedding that she's crashed. And they're intimate with each other in a way that goes way beyond sexual intimacy. That's one of those thrilling sequences. And I saw a line from Trier who said, "We always wanted to make a warm film shot in 35mm with more color, with scenes that almost feel like a musical without actually being in a musical. You know what I mean?" And I think I do know what he means. So I'm going to bookend my outlier picks here with an actual musical, Annette, and this one that at times has that exuberance and the joy, but also the pain of a great musical, The Worst Person in the World, my number 2 film of the year, which unfortunately, Josh, isn't available at the moment. I think it's finally going to hit U.S. theaters in early February 2022.
Well, you mentioned musical in that comment, and there's that entire sequence where everyone mm-hmm. else in the city freezes and Julie yep. kind of walks through past everyone. And that's a very musical staging sequence and one of mm-hmm. those flourishes. You know, when you talked about both the lead performance and Anders Danielsson Lee, who is a Trier regular collaborator, mm-hmm. when we did our best of the CFCA ballot show when we made our acting picks, and I hadn't seen this yet. So I watched it with those in mind. And yes, Lee is absolutely devastating in a supporting part. I think he has a line reading, if I'm remembering correctly, is also a riff on the movie's title that is just, you know, a heartbreaker, the way he delivers it and what he's offering to Julie in that moment, I think, mm-hmm. And particularly won't give spoilers considering the situation he finds himself in at that moment. So, yeah, some really good performances in this and probably my favorite of Trier's films that I've seen.
I was nervous because when we talked about it last week, that is the first point I had seen the movie and I'd mentioned to you that it was going to be pretty high on my top 10 list. And you did hear me say that Renata Reinsvoe was going to be my lead actress of the year. So I knew that you would be burdened with that watching the movie. But judging from what you've said and from your star rating, it didn't put any undue pressure on the film. It delivered.
It delivered. And she's great as well. You described sort of the presence that her character brings that I think she lives into. And I think you're absolutely right about the filmmaking matching that, being inspired by that, which is distinct from what Trier has done in other films of his. So it's nice to see that development in a filmmaker as well.
So we're halfway through, basically. We have each, as it turns out, shared 5 outlier picks, movies unique to our individual lists. You will not hear them again on next week's show. Didn't make Michael Phillips' list, didn't make Dana's list, but we did have, I think, 8 movies that appeared on multiple lists. We'll dive into those next week on the show. That's it for part 1 of our top 10 films of 2021 countdown.
If you want to share your outliers, movies that you love this year you haven't seen on a lot of top 10 lists, go ahead and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter. We're also on Letterboxd. You can find Adam at FilmSpotting. I'm at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top 5s going back to 2005. And you can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll. It's Golden Brick time, and it's your chance to weigh in. We want to know what film should win the 2021 Golden Brick Award. The winner of the poll will be factored in to the equation to choosing the winner for the final award. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out in limited release this weekend, Licorice Pizza expanding to more screens. Finally, the latest from Paul Thomas Anderson's 70mm at the Music Box here in Chicago. Pedro Almodovar's Parallel Mothers and Joel Coen's The Tragedy of Macbeth. Good stuff coming to theaters this weekend if you are lucky enough to have one of these movies playing near you. In wide release, you can see The King's Man, The Matrix Resurrections, which is also available on HBO Max, Sing 2, and the latest from director George Clooney, The Tender Bar. On digital, Adam McKay, Don't Look Up, comes to Netflix, a movie that only screened once prior to its opening, and we happen to be recording our show that night. So who knows? Maybe Don't Look Up would be another Adam McKay film that would be number one on my year-end list like The Big Short was, though it seems like that's probably not the case.
Yeah, I if it was, it sounds like I might have to roll my eyes at that pick as well again. But I will say, to speak more positively, I was able to see The Matrix Resurrections, and I'm going to put that in the good stuff basket. Is that what you said? A lot of good stuff?
Cool.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Next week, as we said, top 10 of 2021, part 2. Michael Phillips, Dana Stevens, they'll be here. Don't miss it.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Kat Sullivan. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.